The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, I am Avra Lewis for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Black Teachers Speak Out. Earlier this year, schools across the U.S. hastily shut down and teachers began adapting to a new remote learning normal. Now, months into the pandemic, educators around the country have geared up for the new school season, and they have a lot to say. Alexis Carpenter, an elementary school teacher in Oakland, began the last school year without a working printer. It took a 5-minute drive to the nearest school campus to find a printer to prepare handouts, reports, and assessments. The printer was shared among all staff on both campuses for the first month or so of school, she recalls. We finally had a printer set up at each campus. Never mind that she had to share the machine with at least 18 other staff members. Every year, Carpenter resorts to storing away copy paper, as there's always a shortage. She also finds herself coming out of the pocket for classroom materials to support the development of all 135 students in her class, 35 of whom are English language learners. In Essex, Virginia, a low-income Black community on the other side of the country, first-year teacher Camilla Rucker started her career and the academic year expecting to jump right into the state's fourth-grade writing curriculum. Fourth graders are expected to learn to write research-based papers and pull relevant evidence from text to support their thesis before the end of the school year. Rucker soon realized that she would have to temporarily abandon these goals and hunt for resources and materials to teach skills and concepts that her students should have grasped in previous grades. A lot of my students come in not knowing the basics and the foundations for a fourth grade curriculum, she says. So I had to teach them basics like nouns and verbs just to move forward with their writing. They didn't know how to compose a paragraph. They didn't know the writing process at all. The prevalence of inadequate support and lack of student readiness followed Black instructors into their remote learning classrooms. When U.S. schools went into lockdown in March 2020, the global pandemic brought out the educators' resourcefulness while simultaneously exposing new ways in which educational disparities uniquely harm low-income Black children and families. Faculty members like Shanice Sasser, an English teacher at a STEM middle school in Georgia, prioritized staying in touch with students' families so they could stay abreast of weekly learning goals. Part of our communication plan was to increase our social media presence, Sasser says. We built PLNS, which stands for Professional Learning Networks, with other educators using Twitter, posted videos and pictures to Instagram and YouTube, and went live on Instagram and Facebook for parents. It was important for us to consistently communicate our expectations. Every day, we posted morning messages and closing messages at the same time that we would have had we been in school. With the support of the school administration, Sasser was also able to launch Parent Lunch and Learn, a week-long series focused on helping parents think in terms of earning additional income through tutoring. So many people were out of work, explained Sasser. As a part-time entrepreneur, I knew that this was the perfect time to inspire parents to tap into their genius to make money. The next article is titled Black Judge Magic. Within seconds of wrapping up a long-awaited phone call from a representative of the Colorado Governor's Office last spring, Jill Durancy excitedly dialed up her parents in Brooklyn, where she grew up. Durancy was still in shock as she shared the news with her folks, both of whom had immigrated to the United States from Haiti as asylum seekers and later became American citizens. Now their daughter had achieved a new milestone. Durancy told her parents she would officially be made Colorado's newest district court judge on July 1st, 2020. My mom was thrilled. And she started crying, too, recalls Durancy, 47. Then I called my dad and told him the news in Haitian Creole. He said, "What do you mean?" And I was like, "Poppy, it means I made it. I'm a judge." Durancy, who most recently litigated oil and gas cases for a Denver firm, says the weeks since that May 15th call have felt surreal and dreamlike. Adding to her sense of wonder is the awareness that her achievement is historic. She is the fifth Black woman to be appointed to the statewide bench by Colorado Governor Jared Polis since he took office in January 2019. He has chosen more Black women judges than his 42 predecessors combined. Polis sees judicial appointments will also set a new record for the highest number of Black women serving concurrently on Colorado's statewide judiciary, bringing the total number of Black women judges to 8, not counting magistrates who preside over courts but don't have the full judicial authority of judges. This is the kind of leadership that really gives you hope, says Durancy, a divorced mother of 2 teenagers. I'm honored and humbled to have been appointed by a governor who is committed to ensuring diversity on the bench. In a statement provided exclusively to Essence, Polis agreed on the importance of a truly diverse judiciary. I am honored to appoint several highly qualified and dedicated Black women to serve in Colorado's judicial branch. It is about time. I am committed to building a Colorado for all, which is why we need more people of color in positions of leadership and represented in our government in order to truly reflect our community. To many, this unprecedented and undeniable moment is exciting, if somewhat surprising, milestone for a state that is 84% white and has a mere 4% Black population. It is a place more likely to conjure images of snow-capped mountains, ski resorts, and legal marijuana than groundbreaking diversity benchmarks. It's not the first place that people from outside the state would think of as diverse, agrees Pax Moultrie, 40, a former county attorney who previously clerked for 2 justices. This is an example of what happens when people in leadership positions embrace and value diverse talent. If it can happen here in Colorado, it can happen anywhere. Polis appointments also stand out because Black judges, especially women judges, have historically been few and far between in statewide courts in Colorado. Former Governor John Hickenlooper, for example, appointed a total of 2 Black women during his 8 years in office. Colorado's diversity is our strength, and I am proud of the forward-minded approach my legal team and our administration have made thus far, says Polis, a Democrat who has made history in January 2019 as the nation's first openly gay governor. But there is more work to be done to ensure there is more diversity on the bench and in our justice system. The governor kicked off his appointments in October 2019 with the selection of Francis Johnson for the 4th Judicial District Court in Colorado Springs, making the former magistrate the first Black woman appointed to a district court position of general jurisdiction. Polis followed up in November 2019 with Nakia Bland, who became the first black woman appointed to a Denver District Court of General Jurisdiction. It's 2020, and there shouldn't be any black first left, but here we are, says Bland, a married mother of two young sons and a former public defender and private practice defense attorney. I am just glad to see we are finally moving forward in progress. This past February, Polis tapped Moultrie for the Denver Juvenile Court with the news of Sam Orian, quote-unquote Sam, Bernie's appointment to the 4th Judicial District County Court in Colorado Springs following in April. And at Durancy's swearing in July, she became one of the 8 black women currently serving among Colorado's more than 160 judges. I hope that the message being sent in Colorado and across the country is that we black women shouldn't be overlooked, says Bernie, an Orlando native and former prosecutor. We are qualified, we add value, and we are a benefit to the system, not just by our presence, but because of the diverse experiences, backgrounds, and perspectives that we all bring. We are 5 black women, but we each bring something different to the table, aside from the fact that we are enhancing inclusivity and diversity in the state's judiciary, we all deserve to be here. Johnson agrees that the appointments mark a turning point for Colorado. It is difficult for a society, for a community to claim that the legal system is fair when people go in front of judges and don't see the makeup of the community reflected there, says the former court magistrate. I think Governor Polis is very much aware of that. So I think it is a positive thing, not only his awareness, but also his commitment to leading change. It not only reflects his mindset, but also that of our state. Scott Evans, president of the Sam Carey Bar Association, Colorado's black bar organization, says the appointments are indeed noteworthy and are the result of recent diversity initiatives. This is the direct result of the efforts of Denver County Court Judge Gary Jackson, a dedicated champion for diversity on the bench in Colorado, explains Evans, a commercial litigation attorney. He has remained in contact with Governor Polis as well as previous Colorado governors on this issue. To his credit, Governor Polis has been made aware of this problem and has been willing to address it. He has definitely come through in a big way. The gravity of the groundbreaking moment is not lost on Honorable Claudia Jordan, a former public defender who became Colorado's first black woman judge in 1994, when Denver's first black mayor, Wellington Webb, appointed her to the Denver County Court. 4 years later, in 1998, Karen Ashby was tapped for the Denver Juvenile Court, becoming the first black woman appointed by a Colorado governor. It would be nearly 14 more years before Cheryl Rose Stokes joined them in 2013, becoming only the 2nd black woman appointed by a Colorado governor to a statewide court. I am very happy about this, but my question is, and always has been, why did it take so long, says Jordan. It is definitely a time to rejoice. I am glad it's happening now, but I don't want it to stop. Everyone wins when diversity is championed on the bench. Jordan, who retired in 2014 and is now a private practice attorney, says the recent appointments bring back memories, both positive and not, from her 20-year tenure. She recalls, for example, how some lawyers would challenge her authority in court and how police officers openly read newspapers in the jury box during her traffic court days. And once, a white juror sized her up during jury selection, commenting, "Well, you don't look like a judge," to which Jordan immediately retorted, What exactly does a judge look like? I think I helped make more important changes during my time, and I am confident that these women will also do the same, says Jordan now. All five appointees say they are hopeful that their presence will also help to illuminate the work still to be done, including the recruitment of more Latinos, Asians, women, and others from underrepresented diverse backgrounds to the bench. For example, there are still no black judges on the state appellate courts, which include Colorado Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. So we stop and celebrate only for a moment as we continue to close this diversity gap in the Colorado judiciary, says former SCBA President Terrain Bailey. As for Durancy, she remains optimistic about her and her fellow appointees' future on the Colorado bench. Yes, we are black women, and there's black girl magic, but it is important not to get lost in that, she says. We're not all monolithic. We are all very different people, and it is those differences that help make us special and uniquely qualified to serve. The next article is titled, Black Teachers Speak Out Against the Achievement Gap. Faculty members like Shawnice Sasser, an English teacher at a STEM middle school in Georgia, tried to help parents find a more secure footing. Alexis Carpenter, an elementary school teacher in Oakland, looked for ways to support her lowest performing students. She noticed that their attendance was inconsistent because of their parents' work demands. As an educator in a struggling community, she understood that the less than optimal remote learning conditions would negatively impact their quality of instruction and exacerbate an already bad achievement gap, defined by black and Hispanic children lagging an average of 2 to 3 years behind white students of the same age on standardized tests. Some of the parents have essential jobs, so they have to bring their children to work, Carpenter notes. Maybe they can't afford to have someone take care of them because they are a single parent. I didn't want the achievement gap to grow, yet I knew those students who were already behind weren't the ones showing up. In addition to setting up automated reminders for parents to review daily homework, Carpenter also recorded her lessons so that students who couldn't be available during her remote class could catch up afterward. I plan to leave the lessons up so they can always go back, Carpenter says. For every teacher able to engage with students and parents via technology, many others ran smack into the digital divide, the gulf between those who have ready access to computers and the internet and those who do not. It was hard for me to teach because my students lived in areas where they didn't have the internet, says Rucker. So I gave them packets. I couldn't teach live, so I would use Google Classroom for assignments. Of her 50 students, only 10 consistently turned in assignments on time. Richmond, Virginia-based high school Spanish teacher Brittany Flippin faced a similar dilemma in that many of her young adult students initially couldn't log in regularly because they had to share a single computer with younger siblings. Some also lived in temporary housing with other families or had to respond to the financial realities of COVID-19. In addition to trying to get their schoolwork done, some kids picked up jobs to help out at home, shares Flippin. Many of my students came to me and said, "It's not that I don't want to do your work, but I got a new job now. I'm helping take care of the house." The next article is titled, On Puerto Rico, Blackness and Being When Nations Aren't Enough. In her op-ed, Jessica A. Krug examines the constructs of empire, state, and language, and imagines the radical possibilities for Black freedom beyond them. Que viva Puerto Rico Libre! We cry, waving the flag of a never-realized national dream under the leaden skies of empire. But what has that aspiration, that flag, any flag, ever held for Black people beyond the vanishing promises of profit from the spoils of war? In the wake of the abolition of slavery, white people concocted policy and myth to secure their power. Across the Americas, nations sponsored white immigration, while former enslavers throughout the hemisphere promoted the mythologies of mixing, the notion that national character is a blend of indigenous, African, and European roots that persist. This glorification of genocide and rape relegates indigenous and Black people to a nostalgic past and forecloses the possibility of a Black present or future. The beneficiaries of the world enslavers built have no more right to claim Blackness by proximity or linguistic affinity in San Juan than they do in St. Louis. Arguing for the existence of Black people in the Americas reinforces the insidious lie that Blackness is tied to U.S. empire, that 1619 was the beginning of the Black history in the Americas, that divisions of empire and language shape Black realities more than shared histories of resistance do, and that the borders that cross us determine our lives more than the borders we cross, transgress, and dissolve. These arguments amplify those who cast their fates with the empires that never cast their fates with us. In 1538, Juan Gordillo, born in Congo, successfully petitioned the Spanish crown for a pension on the basis of decades of service in the conquest and suppression of indigenous people, including the Aztecs and the people of both Cuba and Puerto Rico. In 1912, the Cuban state, with the aid of the United States, executed more than 2,000 Black veterans of the War of Independence who had the temerity to mobilize for the citizenship for which they had fought. Black World War II veterans across the world made claims on empires, and their disenchantment with their exclusion helped drive both the civil rights movement in the United States and independence struggles across Africa. In 2014, 2 years before President Obama signed PROMESA into law and placed authority over Puerto Rico into the hands of an appointed board, Black veterans received some long overdue recognition when he awarded the Puerto Rican Regiment of the U.S. Infantry a Congressional Gold Medal for their willingness to execute the nation's agenda in every war for more than a century. These long epochs of killing and being killed in service to empire have not won Black people citizenship, but what they have produced is an alignment of ambitions for citizenship and murderous misogynoir that builds on a 5-centuries-long gendered legacy of multiplying violence. Blackness, specifically Black girlhood and womanhood, is not and never has been tethered to the United States identities. In any and every language, empires slaughter Black women with unexceptional regularity. We cry the names of those executed by the state, and the statistics of femicide and trans femicide in Puerto Rico crush us beneath the cumulative toll. Every 7 days, someone murders a Puerto Rican woman, and the U.S. is directly culpable for the deaths of more than 4,645 children and adults in the wake of Hurricane Maria, with approximately 140,000 Puerto Ricans having access to water only every other day, the scale of death grows in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. The same refrigerated trucks filled with family members that haunt the refugees of Hurricane Katrina and Maria will now haunt the Black children of New York, Texas, and Florida, and Puerto Rico again. These casualties of colonialism, state violence, and the allocation of resources for the enrichment of colonizers are devastating, whether in Fajardo or Flint. Draping ourselves in the flag, any flag, means that our lips too are crimson with blood of our siblings. What world is possible to dream and build when Blackness alone, without the sulfuric seal of colony or state, is enough, is everything? The title of the next article is Black Teachers Speak Out About the Other Side. Parent responses to academic personnel during these uncertain times underscore the important role educators play in our society. Amber L. Wright, a communications coach and consultant who is a mother to two young daughters, admits to having a greater appreciation now for the multiple hats teachers wear. I thought a lot about the families who didn't have computers for their children, didn't have access to the internet, who might need support in school, who might need tutoring, she says. The teacher serves as the one portal to all other resources. For some kids, I often wondered how teachers handled all of that. Aaliyah Abraham is a community activist and mother. Her first grade son is enrolled in a gifted and talented program with a class size of 33 in Cambria Heights, New York. She recognized that teachers possesses a unique skill set after becoming her son's primary classroom instructor during 4 months of social distancing. As a parent, you become more appreciative of classroom teachers now that you have been on the other side, Abraham says. Teaching requires patience, and it requires knowing each child. You can't just have a blanket education plan, because each child has different circumstances and different ways they learn. It is more than just teaching them how to read and write. It is also about the emotional support that you have to give each child all day long. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you have enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.